It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about some of the common maladies that affect yards and gardens this time of year. But first, whether your lawn is lush or patchy, there's probably something you can learn from the turf grass experts at Iowa State University. ISU Extension turf grass specialist Ryan Adams is here. Hello, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
And you have a turf grass field day coming up next Thursday. Tell me a little bit about it.
That is correct. So usually it's a commercial field day. So we reach out to all the lawn care companies, athletic field managers, and also golf courses. This year we've decided to kind of go a little bit different direction. We kind of added a homeowner and master gardener track this year. So we're really trying to encourage those people that want to learn more about their lawn to come out and meet us and ask us any questions they may have.
All right. And will you get an opportunity to see some of the different kinds of grasses that you teach people about that have been planted and tested?
Yep, definitely. So, you know, we're going to talk about low maintenance alternatives to Kentucky bluegrass. There's a lot of reasons that Kentucky bluegrass is 95% of the lawns in Iowa, but there are some low maintenance alternatives, fine fescues, tall fescues that do very, very well in certain situations. So they'll get the chance to look at those, and we'll kind of talk about them, the different maintenance, and how to establish them.
All right, and even some ornamental grasses as well?
A little bit. So Cindy Haynes and a couple other horticulturists will be talking about some of those things, more to the lawn care side, but also we encourage the switch. If you see a talk that's saying lawn care, go and listen to it if that's something that interests you. You don't have to stay in one track. We do have the tracks trying to make it as kind of specific and directed towards what they would be interested in, but go anywhere you want.
All right. And so, as you mentioned, in past years, you've focused more on people who are working on golf courses or soccer fields, things like that. But this year, it really is more for them as well, but also for the homeowner.
Exactly. So just trying to get as much education as possible and give those resources to anybody who wants information.
All right. So the Turf Grass Field Day is next Thursday, and people can still register?
That is correct. So $30 registration. That also includes lunch from Hickory Park. It's out at the Turf Horticulture Research Station. And you could, if you want to register, probably the best way to do it as a homeowner or master gardener is by calling 515-635-0306.
All right. And you can find out more about the field day on our Facebook page. We'll also put up a link on the webpage when we put up our Horticulture Day post a little bit later on today. But Ryan Adams, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
ISU Extension turf grass specialist Ryan Adams, the field day is coming up next Thursday. And now we're going to move on to troubleshooting. Aaron Style is the assistant director of Ryman Gardens, and we're going to talk about some of the common maladies that we see in our yards and gardens this time of year. Hello, Aaron.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we've had quite a lot of moisture, and of course, there are always things that crop up this time of year. What are some of the things that we're starting to see?
Oh, you know, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about the early and septorial leaf blight on tomato. Lots and lots of questions about that. A lot of people grow tomatoes. This spring and early summer was perfect for the development of that fungus, and so we're seeing it right now.
All right, so what do we do?
Well, there's not a lot you can do for it, to be quite honest. There's
so,
a lot
so we
of things.
Should just accept that we're not alone.
Well,
and
there's some good things,
little, right?
There's some good things about this situation. One is most tomatoes produce lots of tomatoes, and so typically, even if you have a little bit of this fungus on the plant, you're still going to get tomatoes. You may not get quite as many, or the plant may struggle a little bit more if it's really severe, but it's not going to prevent tomatoes in most cases. So one of the big things is to make sure that you're planning for the future and doing things like rotating your crops, which I know is very difficult in most homeowner gardens. One of the things that I recommend folks do is actually create a vegetable garden that's several raised beds, and then those raised beds can be where you rotate different crops into. So one of them, 1 year or for a couple of years, is all your tomatoes and peppers and other solanaceous crops. And maybe a different one is your beans and corn. And another one is all of your coal crops, like the broccoli and the lettuce and all of that stuff. And then you can rotate between those three beds and hopefully get them far enough apart where you can see some advantage to crop rotation, because you do have to get them a fair distance apart to get the advantages of avoiding this fungus, which overwinters in plant debris and the soil.
All right. And do you need to do anything special to handle the debris this fall?
Yeah, you should definitely clean it up in the fall. Get rid of it. A good garden cleanup goes a long way in the vegetable garden in the fall. So that's a great tactic. You can remove leaves on the lower part of the plant as they become infected, but it's not going to get rid of the disease. You can mulch with grass clippings, with straw. That can help some too. And there are sprays available, but you have to do it constantly. And I always kind of avoid spraying things like food crops if I don't have to.
That makes sense. All right. So beyond the tomatoes, I know a lot of people are also concerned because they're starting to see some powdery mildew show up. And where are we seeing that?
You see it on all sorts of plants, actually. And what's interesting about powdery mildew is it's a group of fungus that attack a lot of different plants, but the same fungus doesn't attack all plants. So the kind of powdery mildew that's on lilac is not going to affect your turf grass, for example. That's a different species of fungus that's attacking your turf grass. But they all thrive under similar conditions. They all look very similar, and their control is difficult. But powdery mildew very rarely kills a plant. It's unsightly. It can cause a little bit of stress, but it's not likely to kill your plant. And we're seeing it a lot on things like phlox and bee balm and lilac and roses and even some turf grass.
Should you do anything to try to treat it?
Well, there are a few things you can do. Things like getting more light. It thrives in low light situations, especially if it's a plant that doesn't want to be in low light, but you've put it there anyway. It's going to be more susceptible to it. You can increase air circulation, which can help a lot. So trimming and removing excess branches or spacing plants appropriately will go a long way. And then really the best defense is finding plants that are naturally resistant to it. Cultivars of plants that are proven to be less susceptible to powdery mildew. Or if you have a big problem with powdery mildew on lilacs, think about a shrub that's not a lilac to plant.
And a lot of these shrubs and different flowers that we were talking about, they're perennials. So if you have a powdery mildew problem this year, what does that mean for next year?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it's about conditions, but it's also you have to have the fungus or the fungal spores there to inoculate for the following year. So good cleanup in the fall in particular is going to go a long way. But environmental factors play a big role in it, too. And we've had some good conditions over the last several weeks for powdery mildew.
Now, something that I've been seeing just walking around and different kinds of trees, I've seen leaves that have changed colors and fallen off the trees.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, I think it depends on the tree. You know, we're seeing a lot of apple scab on things like crab apples, and that would cause leaf drop starting pretty soon if it hasn't started already. I've noticed that in some particularly low-lying areas, because we have been getting a fair amount of rain, not a crazy amount in most parts of Iowa, but enough. We've been seeing a little bit of water stress, especially if plants are in low-lying areas or poorly drained areas. That may cause some yellowing or leaf drop too. There's a whole host of things. You know, yellowing leaves is like probably the most common symptom of a problem. So it's kind of hard to narrow it down.
Tree, right? It seems, and of course, you know, this time of year, it gets a little scary. It's July and my tree is losing leaves, but it is something that we see happen frequently.
Yeah, and a few leaves here or there are not going to be an issue on nearly all plants.
All right. And so again, is there anything to do if you see that you have apple scab, for example? What's your plan of action?
Well, you know, for anything, I think the very first thing is to figure out what exactly is going on. Because if you just kind of do a shotgun method and just try to treat for whatever you think it might be or treat for everything you might think it might be, you're probably not going to be very successful. So identifying what it is it apple scab or is it cedar apple rust? Is it, you know, powdery mildew or is it, something else? Making sure you know what you have, using resources from Iowa State Extension or your local extension office is going to go a long way. For apple scab on crab apple, you can prevent that with fungicidal treatments, but those have to be applied in April. Continuously through usually flower petal drop. So we're too late now. The good news is for apple scab in particular, it's not going to kill the tree. It's going to be unsightly, but it's not going to kill it.
And if I have that problem this year, will I have that problem next
year?
Yes.
Yeah, you will. Good fall cleanup again, removing those leaves that are holding those fungal spores that will infect the tree next year will help. But there are so many crab apples out there and there are so many people who don't do good fall cleanup. Those spores are going to be in the wind. They're going to be around. So if it's something that really bothers you, you would have to come up with a preventative treatment plan starting in April. But really, I suggest finding a cultivar of crab apple that is more resistant to this. Planting the right tree from the beginning will be your best bet for preventing this issue in the future. And knowing that just because you have apple scab doesn't mean you're less of a person. It's not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. It is unsightly, but it's not going to kill the tree outright. So putting up with it is probably my next solution even before going the fungicide route, because the fungicide route's a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
And if you are in a situation where your tree loses its leaves in the summer, are the odds pretty good that it will come back, at least if this is the first time we've been through this?
Yeah, it depends on how much stress the tree's under. If it's relatively happy where it's at, then you're fine. But if you compound this with, say, poor drainage or a really tough winter or some other issues, you could run into problems that could kill the tree.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in just a moment. They will answer your questions. So give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. And joining us now, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And Aaron was talking about all of the common things that are popping up. Are those the phone calls you're getting right now, too?
Yeah, quite a bit of questions on your tomato blights. Very common. Like Aaron said, we've had ideal conditions for that. And realistically, there's not a whole lot you can do for this year. So you just kind of harvest what you can, salvage what you can, and plan for next year.
All right. Here's an email to start off with. This is from Joel. With fall coming, please give basic information on seeding and overseeding new and existing lawns. When and how?
Well, if you want to overseed an existing lawn, I would aim for basically late August, the last week in August or the first week in September. And if you're overseeding, I would probably go out with a core aerator and pull out plugs of soil and run over the yard maybe two or three times with that core aerator pulling out plugs, and then go ahead and sow your grass seed and then drag the lawn with either a drag mat or a piece of fencing like chain link fencing. And that would break up the soil cores and also work some of the seed into the soil. And then after that, try to keep the seed bed moist, and that grass should come up.
All right. And I can't believe how soon all of that
pretty soon,
is,
yeah.
is happening. All right. Here's an email from Lynn. I'm fighting with my husband about our lawn care service. I feel that commercial lawn care services use an excessive amount of herbicides. We have grandchildren come and play on our lawn, and I'm worried about them being exposed to chemicals. How long after an application can we wait to roll around in the grass?
That's hard to say, but they typically have to label it when they do treat, and that's 24 hours. And so just walking across the yard 24 hours, I don't see a problem. I really don't. As far as rolling around, that's a little bit different. But the key thing would be definitely do not allow them to do that when the grass is wet after the application, if they're using a water-soluble product. And keep them off as long as you can.
And with a water-soluble product, if they choose to use a sprinkler or something like that, does that sort of make the chemicals go more quickly?
Well, typically if you apply a spray, you don't want rain for 24 hours. You want the weeds to have a chance to absorb the herbicide. So really, you don't want any type of moisture after the application if it's a liquid product.
Okay. Let's go to the phones now. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Amy is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Amy.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a very thick magnolia tree. It's a tree that's probably about 50 years old, and it started by dripping out sort of like a black tar substance, and now when I look up under the tree, it has white, fuzzy growths all over it, and if you stand under the tree, it sort of drips on you. Can it be saved?
Well, what you have is magnolia scale, which is an insect, and basically what the insect is doing, it's sucking sap from the branch tissue, and it's feeding on the sugar within that sap. But then it has all this waste product to get rid of, so it excretes that, so that sticky, clear sap falls on anything below where the insect is. And so it may accumulate, for example, on plants beneath the tree, if you have patio furniture, whatever, beneath that tree. And then you get a sooty mold, which grows on that sticky sap, which turns it black.
Oh, okay.
As far as the insect, it's hard to control, but you can spray with an insecticide. Now, as far as the timing, I'm not quite sure on that, but if you go to the Iowa State University homepage and type in magnolia scale, it should go to an article by Donald Lewis where he talks about treating it. And I think it's later on, I believe, around mid to late August with an insecticide.
Okay.
We've seen a lot of magnolia scale at the gardens this year. It's particularly bad for some reason.
Very optimistic it can be managed.
Right. You're going to have to be persistent where you apply an insecticide later on this summer, and also a dormant oil spray possibly early next spring. And so you may have to repeat this for maybe a year or two. But I think if you're persistent, you can control it.
All right, Amy, thank you so much for your call. Next up, we've got Frank in Fairfield. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
So I have I planted some giant pumpkin seeds early in or late May in the house, got them started, got them out outside in June. I've got huge leaves and a bunch of flowers, but I'm not quite sure what to do next. I've seen some people say that you're supposed to cut off the flowers and choose one pumpkin, and I don't know quite exactly how to judge what to do.
Well, I think basically what you do is you wait, and many of those flowers are male flowers. They will not develop into fruit. They can't. But the females can if they're pollinated by pollen from the male flowers. So when you see one or two pumpkins developing on the vine, then I would prevent any additional pumpkins from forming. So
any females, in other words.
Right. If you see additional pumpkins starting to form, I would simply remove them so that all the resources of that vine go into the remaining fruit that you have.
Cool. I see. Do I have to manually fertilize the females?
No, you shouldn't have to. No. The bees should do it, the pollinators should do that. And you only need one or two per vine, no more than two. And anything beyond that, you simply remove.
I see. Okay. And they just keep producing both males and females.
They will do that through the rest of the summer, right. And so what you want to do is, if any additional fruit begin to form, cut those off so all the resources of that vine go into remaining fruit.
All right, Frank. Thanks a lot for your call. The number 866-780-9100. Brent is on the line next in West Des Moines. Hi, Brent.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I have four apple trees that are all in a group together, and three of them are very healthy. And then about a month ago, one of them started, the apples stopped growing, full of apples, and the leaves started to turn yellow and become a little bit greenish. I'm curious what it might be, if it's treatable, and if I should be thinking about cutting the tree down so it doesn't affect the other three.
Well, one possibility would be apple scab. With that, you tend to get some rather dark spots on the foliage, but the vast majority of the leaf turns yellow and then it drops off. And that's happening.
Most of them are off now.
Okay. So it may be simply a very severe case of apple scab. Now, apple varieties, just like crab apples, vary in their resistance to apple scab. So the other varieties might very well be apple scab resistant, which is great. You don't have to do anything. This spring, we had ideal conditions for apple scab. Ideal. Very wet conditions, cool conditions. And the actual infections occur in the spring, typically May, early June. And so it's up to you as far as I would probably keep the tree if it does produce good apples, edible apples, because the severity of apple scab does vary somewhat according to the weather. If we have, for example, a dry spring, far less rain, it's not going to be as severe as at all. So it does vary. But I don't think the tree is dying, so I would be inclined to leave it and see what it does next spring.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Brent, thanks a lot for your call. Next, Rick in Dubuque. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a maple tree that about one-third of the leaves have already turned red like they would in the fall, and I'm wondering what the problem is and what I can do to solve it.
Well, early fall color, especially on a thing, something like a shade tree, is usually a sign of some kind of stress. That tree is responding to stress and in the process is having some early fall color. So, I think the best course of action for you is to figure out what might be causing that stress. Do you have poor drainage? Is there some damage to the limbs that are turning that color? Is it in that spot between the curb and the sidewalk that's really stressful for trees? Looking at some of those conditions may help. I mean, do you see any of that stuff happening with your tree now?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So especially I see it a lot with in parking lot trees. You'll notice that trees in parking lots always color up sooner, and it's because they're under a lot of stress. And you see it a lot in trees that, in particular, trees that are in low spots that don't tolerate wet feet very well. And we've had a fair amount of rain, and especially if the soil is particularly poorly drained or if it's in a low spot, you may have some root damage that's causing that issue. And there's not much you can do about that, but wait it out if it's that case.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks very much.
All right, Rick. Thanks a lot for your call. And Dan in Iowa City has a similar problem with his serviceberry. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yeah, it sounds like the other two callers to a great degree. Mine is just a small percentage of the leaves have put on their fall colors a little bit early. We had a good crop of the serviceberries early on. I've got two trees, and one seems to be suffering a little bit more than the other. They're not in particularly low ground, but they should have gotten their share of rain. One is in the parkway in between the sidewalk and the street, and it's the one that's doing better. The one that's got more grass around it is the one that's dropping leaves, or at least coloring leaves.
Right. I'm assuming that's some type of leaf spot also. I have a serviceberry. It's lost a few leaves this summer, a few, just a small percentage, maybe 5% or less.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about that, but I think it's probably some type of fungal leaf spot. So I wouldn't do a thing.
Well, I'm less worried now. Thank you very much.
All right, Dan. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we've got Maxine in Mason City. Hi, Maxine.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have a pussy willow that's very full, probably 2.5 feet tall, very healthy. We moved it this spring. It's in a nice place with lots of air and sun and circulation. It is covered with that pink, it's not scale, it's the stuff that covers mites. And the new growth is really peaked and horrible looking. Is there anything we can do?
Okay, these are pink?
Well, they're like little pink nodes that, you know, they look like scale that might be on a, and some of them are white, but they start off as bright pink. Mm. And someone told me they're little scales that cover little groups of mites underneath.
Okay.
And there was nothing that we you could do about it. But the new growth looks horrible.
Okay. Do these objects have legs?
No.
Body parts?
The little, you can't see the mites. The little scale covers that. They're just little pink nodes all over the leaves.
Up and down the branches or on the leaves?
On the leaves.
On the underside of the leaves, along the veins?
No, on the top of the leaves.
Okay. See, I was trying to figure out if they were aphids or scale.
Yeah.
No, actually, when I asked somebody, said they're really not scale at all. They're, I don't know, something that covers, a shell that covers little mites underneath.
Well, that's what scale is. Scale is an insect that basically has like a protective covering, almost like a turtle.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So they don't move.
Right.
You don't see any body parts like legs.
No, nothing. Just all these little hard pink, dark pink bumps. Some of them are white, but the majority are pink.
So if it's scale, then I would simply put on a dormant oil spray early next spring, and that typically takes care of most of the scale.
Okay.
Basically what it does, it's hard to control scale with a traditional insecticide because they have this protective covering, and most insecticides are contact insecticides. You have to get the insecticide on the insect, and with that protective covering, you can't. But if you put on a dormant oil spray early in the spring before bud break, basically the dormant oil spray suffocates the actual scale. So that's how it works.
All right. Maxine, thank you so much for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 as well. And let's go back to a couple email questions here. This one is from Nikki. What time of year is a good time to move hydrangea bushes?
I would say early spring before bud break.
Yeah, not now.
Not now, yes. Not a good time.
All right. This one's from Jefferson and Ames. I was wondering what the best native turf grass would be to replace traditional turf grasses.
Best native.
There's not a lot of turf grasses that are truly native here. There are buffalo grass is
would be a possibility.
Is a possibility. That is a native to the short grass prairie that can be mowed. It has a slightly different color. It is a warm season grass, so it doesn't green up as early as our Kentucky bluegrass lawns do, but it is greener throughout the summer. But I would call it more of a bluish green color.
Right, right.
It's not green. Like a Kelly green like Kentucky bluegrass can get. And so that is an option. I don't know off the top of my head. I know some folks who have a blue grama lawn. That's not for the uninitiated, though. That's something that you would want to do a lot of research on before you did.
Well, it seems like buffalo grass sort of went through a period of popularity and then fell off a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's a little – it's you manage it differently than the typical cool season grass. And a lot of us aren't familiar with it, and quite frankly, we struggle with it a little bit because it does differently.
And it likes dry conditions. So like in a year like this year where it's very, very wet – you tend to maybe get a lot of weeds growing in it because they thrive with all the moisture, and the buffalo grass prefers a kind of a drier environment.
All right, but definitely an option if you're looking for something native for your yard. Here's an email from John. I recently cut down my ash trees in my front yard. This morning I noticed that I had a large number of small mushrooms in my yard, especially near where the old trees were located. I've lived here for more than 30 years and haven't seen this before. Is it related to cutting down the ash trees, and do I need to do anything about them?
Well, yes, it is related. Basically, what you're seeing are fungi that are breaking down the roots in the soil. And these are the reproductive structures of the fungus. And so they're going to do this periodically, probably for several years. And you really can't do anything to prevent them from coming up. So if they bother you, you can go out and pick them up and discard them, but you can't apply anything to the ground to prevent them from coming up.
They're actually doing good work, though. I mean, they're breaking down all those roots.
It's a
good thing overall in the grand scheme of things. The mushrooms are annoying.
But they can be annoying, yes.
Yeah.
All right, here's a tweet from Don. I was told not to do onion sets for a fall crop. Why?
With onion sets, you don't know the variety. You don't know if they store well. So if I want something to store well, I buy a variety that is known for its keeping quality. So that's the key there.
All right. So that's something you might play with in the springtime, but not
I would use them more for green onions, short-term storage, because you have no idea as far as the cultivar or variety.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. You can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And they are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, post on our Facebook page, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, we've got Marty on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Marty.
How are you? Thanks.
Good. What's your question?
My question is an ash tree question. My ash tree is dropping leaves that have these little, I don't know what you would call them. They look like if they could grow, they would be caterpillars. They're green, and they're little round mounds that come up off the leaves, and they're real fleshy looking. And not all the tree is dropping this, but there are quite a few of them that I can see in the tree. Wondering if I should have somebody look in case of ash borer?
I'm not sure what that is offhand.
Does it look like a little growth on the leaf, or does it look like something that's attached to it?
Well, it looks like a growth, actually.
Okay.
It'd be like a wart.
Okay. Mm. Kind of sounds like maybe a gall, possibly. Galls are very common. They're induced to form by typically small little insects. They inject a chemical into the plant tissue early in the spring. And then this tissue grows abnormally, forming the gall. And so galls are very common on trees like oaks and maples and other trees. The galls do not cause serious harm to the tree. The damage is mainly aesthetic. There are some galls that are so commonplace, like the hackberry gall, that we use that gall to identify the tree because it's very, very distinctive. So I'm guessing it might be a gall that you're seeing. That's G-A-L-L.
L-L, So it isn't a precursor of ash borer?
No, not at all. No, not at all.
Okay, they're just very strange-looking creatures, but they're like a wart that gets bigger than most warts.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you've relieved me very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Marty.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good day. Bye. Next up, we've got Helen on the line in Ames. Hi, Helen.
Yes, so I've got two questions. I was out in my garden this morning, and I noticed on my dill, I had a, I don't know if it was a caterpillar or a tomato horn. I looked to see if I could see any horns on it. Would they be on dill, a tomato horn?
Tomato horn wouldn't, but a swallowtail would. And that would be a large caterpillar.
Yeah, I think it was a caterpillar. Do those turn into butterflies?
Yep, they sure do.
Oh, I went and snipped it off. I didn't snip it. I just snipped the dill off and laid the branch some other place because I thought it was tomato horn. Well, I won't do that again. And my second question is, I had to go to the hospital in April and May, and I had planted spinach and lettuce, but now I got to take this cumin, so I couldn't eat the spinach and lettuce. So it all went up the weeds. Now, in the fall, I can't hold them out. How can I get them out of there? What can I put on there to kill them, the weeds?
To kill the weeds?
Yeah, I can't hold them out. I could hold them out if I had enough energy, but I can't seem to do that.
Well, your options are limited, I guess, if you can't do that.
No, I can't. I'm 82 years old,
okay,
and I can't do it.
Maybe you could lay a piece of tarp or something across the area to kill or smother the weeds. You could do that if you had
that's an idea.
A tarp.
Mm-hmm. Ah, that's an idea. How about getting some type of these things that kill weeds, poison things?
A herbicide, I would refrain from that. You could use Roundup if you wanted to. That would kill everything, and then you could plant later on. That would be the only herbicide that I would use.
Yeah, I wouldn't use it until the fall, till my tomatoes and everything were. You know, I got all my beans out of there, all my onions out of there. My tomatoes are just coming on, so I'd wait till October.
Yeah. Most herbicides have some residual left in the soil, which could impact things in the future. One exception to that is Roundup, which is why we would suggest if you used any herbicide at all to use that one. But I think like a couple heavy cardboard boxes, a dark tarp laid down could achieve the same thing for you. It'll take a little bit longer, but you have until the fall, right?
All right. Well, Helen, thank you so much for your call, and I hope you continue to feel good and feel better. Next up, let's go to Paul in Iowa City. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've been keeping bees for 40 years, so that's sort of the backdrop of my question and observation. I was wondering if there's any grass mixes that also include white clover, all-stack clover seed in it, so... I keep bees in Iowa City, and they do profoundly well because of all the yards that do have clover, and then people mow them before they go to seed. So there's pretty much throughout the summer an abundant nectar source for bees that you don't really find out in, you know, in the country and stuff for commercial beekeeping. So I'm just curious about that, and just an observation. I have about a half yard of grass and clover next to my building business, and I walked out the other day and I counted 24 bees, and I'm sure there were more. So just wondering about that and sending out that information that urban areas are really a pretty good place to keep honeybees.
All right, you're a big fan of white clover. Any response to that?
Well, as far as seed mixes, that used to be quite common, let's say maybe 20, 25 years ago, but it's kind of hard to find those seed mixes right now. But I think you might try just a garden center or possibly a catalog. Some of the catalogs might have those seed mixes, but they used to be much more common 20, 25 years ago.
Although a lot of people are using clover in their gardens as a cover crop, so you could mix your own, right?
Well, that would be a different clover, though.
Oh, okay.
So this would be the Dutch white clover, very common, flowering right now. And it used to be a very, very common sight to see these mixes with Kentucky bluegrass, perennial rye, and also some of the Dutch white clover.
Okay, so maybe a little harder to come by these days. Okay, let's go to the next call. Jeff is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I have a hard maple, a red maple. And the south side of the trunk, all the bark is gone. And at the very top of the tree, the branches are dying. But the rest of the tree looks great. The leaves are great and stuff. But this has been going on for about 2-3 years now.
Right. That's unfortunate. That type of tree is prone to that. The damage occurs typically on the south or southwest side. That's attributed to weather conditions, specifically in the wintertime, which destroys the tissue beneath the bark, and then the bark comes off. There's really not much you can do. Really, it's up to the tree. The tree has to deal with the injury as best it can by itself. Now, if this area is wide, as far as the circumference around the trunk, let's say the tree has lost maybe like 40-50% of the bark on the trunk. That tree is in a very precarious position because it's so large an area that the tree probably can't deal with it very well. And I'm going to guess it's going to get worse and the tree is going to decline and possibly die. If the area is much smaller as far as the circumference, then the tree may grow back over as far as the bark may grow back over the wound, and the tree may be okay. But as far as what we can do, we can't really do much of anything. Painting the exposed wood with a pruning paint or wound dressing doesn't do any good. So basically, we kind of sit back and see what the tree does. And if the damage becomes really, really widespread, it may be the end of the tree at some point.
Okay, should I cut the dead branches out or just let it be?
I would cut out the dead branches, yes. Okay. Definitely.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jeff. And next up, we've got Daisy in Iowa City. Hi, Daisy.
Yes.
Hi. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. My question is that I have some plants in my garden. I think phlox and the other are black-eyed Susans or that kind of plant, and they get this great, the leaves get looking all great, and I don't know how to do about it. And at this point, if it's too late when they are all looking like that, if there's anything I can do in the future to prevent it before it gets there.
Yeah, actually, we were talking about this earlier. It sounds like you have powdery mildew, and plants like phlox in particular are very prone to powdery mildew, and there's not much you can do about it at this point. Most of the, if you wanted to spray it with something, those are mostly used preventatively, and they're not effective once you see this dusting of this fungus on the leaves. You can make sure that they're in full sun. Both of those plants really want full sun, so if they're in part shade, they're more likely to have the powdery mildew. You can thin them out to help increase air circulation. The best course of action is to find varieties that are more resistant to it. And phlox in particular, there are several varieties that have been introduced in the last several years that are much more less susceptible to getting infected by powdery mildew. The good news is it probably won't kill your plant outright. So it's ugly, but the plant will probably be fine in the long run.
And it's also been a particularly bad year for it.
It has been a bad year for it, absolutely.
So next year may be better. All right, Steve is on the line next in Dubuque. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, my dad lives in the south in Tennessee, and he has planted a grass called zoysia grass. And it does really well, doesn't need a lot of watering, holds up pretty well. I was just wondering how well that would do in Iowa.
Well, in Iowa, it does okay, especially in the southern two-thirds of the state. Now, zoysia grass is a warm-season grass, so it's different than our cool-season grasses like Kentucky bluegrass. So with zoysia grass, for example, it greens up late in the spring. It's typically still brown in early May. Then it greens up typically toward the end of May, nice and green during June, July, and August. And then it turns brown again fairly early in the fall. It is extremely heat-tolerant, drought-tolerant, very vigorous, very dense. It kind of crowds out some weeds. One kind of drawback is it doesn't respect property lines, and so it tends to wander into your neighbor's yard, and the neighbor may not want it. And once you have zoysia grass, the other thing is it is extremely hard to get rid of. And so if a neighbor doesn't like it, they're going to have a tough time getting rid of it. So there are some good things about it and some bad things about it, but it's extremely heat tolerant, drought tolerant, very, very vigorous plant, and very, very dense. So it's a possibility in the southern two-thirds of Iowa.
All right. It sounds so Dubuque would be a little north.
It's kind of on,
yeah,
it's kind
on,
the, on the line. I kind of draw, I use like Highway 20, and everything south of that would be like the southern two-thirds of the state. So they're kind of on the line.
So it depends on which line of or which side of Highway 20 you live on. But it also sounds like something you need to consider carefully. That sounds invasive.
Well, it can be.
Well, and all turf is invasive, really, when you get down to it.
But this one especially is very hard to get rid of once you have it. So you should really think hard about it before making that decision. It can be a very good lawn, but if you decide you don't like it in a few years, it's going to be very hard to get rid of.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. Karen's up next in Knoxville. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question about my apricot tree. It's lopsided. All the growth is on, most of the growth is on the south side of it, the sun facing. And I was wondering about pruning it up to even that out.
Well, you can definitely prune it, and I would do that probably in late March, early April, before it begins to leaf out next spring.
Sure. How much do you think I should cut that back?
Well, I would say don't remove more than maybe, let's say, 20% of the tree.
Okay.
And make sure that you're removing entire limbs at their origin and not shearing back the plant or something like that.
Oh,
so that you're
okay.
Going through and you're strategically removing entire branches to to improve the shape.
And if you need to remove more than 20%, space it out over maybe 2 or 3 years.
Right. Well, also about that can I top it a little, or would that be harmful?
Topping is not a good thing. Okay. That means basically just chopping out the top, and no, that tends to create greater problems when you do that.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we've got Stanley in Iowa City. Hi, Stanley.
Hi. I have moved to a new place the past couple of years, and the first year that I moved here, there were some giant things on the bank that faces kind of south, and a friend of mine thought it was American pokeweed. Then we had this dreadful winter, and I didn't see it, but this year, this stuff is back, and it's all over, and I think it's just a nasty weed. Is that right?
Well, pokeweed is a fairly common weed. It's a very large plant. It can be almost like a shrub or a bush. It has these large leaves. The other thing that it has, which are very distinctive, are the fruit.
Yeah.
They are in a cluster, and they are a dark purple color.
Right. When these plants are little, though, they're almost like succulents, and they pull up very easily. And I went out and tried to pull them all up, but there's this one that's giant like that.
Right. No, if you have an older plant, it's a perennial plant. It dies back to the ground each winter. But if you have an older plant, by late summer, you may have a small tree or shrub, as far as this plant can be very big. So if it is pokeweed, it's a perennial. It is a weed. It's a weed. And I would try to remove it by either digging it up or something, but it is a very big perennial-type weed.
All right. Stanley, thanks a lot for your call, and let's try to get one more call in. Here's Karen on the line in Northeast Missouri. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Excuse me. I have a question about peach trees. I've been saving the peach pits off of peaches we've bought from the Georgia peaches, because we lost our peach tree a couple years ago because it was just so old. And I didn't know, I've been letting them dry out. I didn't know if I needed to plant them in an individual pot and let them sprout up or freeze them so they get dormant, or just if you have any idea.
All right. Well, so these are, you're buying them in a commercial grocery store or farmer's market, or where are you getting them?
Farmer's market.
Right. Well, if they are, in fact, from Georgia, the trees probably are not hardy here in Northeast Missouri and Iowa. But if you want to sprout the seed, they need to be exposed to cool temperatures and moisture. And one way of doing that is to plant them outdoors in the fall, about 1 or 2 inches deep.
All right. Good luck with your project. And Richard Duran, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Aaron Stile, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. It's great talking with you.
Aaron Stile is assistant director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.